From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Saudi Arabia has cut diplomatic ties with Iran after protesters stormed a Saudi embassy in Tehran. Iranian leaders were outraged over the execution of a Shiite cleric. And this is just the latest version of an ancient sectarian rivalry between the Shiites and the Sunnis. The journalist Leslie Hazelton has been studying the history of that split, and she says the story itself is amazing. It's vivid and passionate and visceral and practically unknown in the Western world. If it's told at all here, she says, it's given a few sentences. But Hazelton says, let's say you were a Christian and someone tried to boil down the story of Jesus to a couple of sentences. So Hazelton will be with us today to take us through the particulars of Islam's first civil war. It's a story, she says, that's still unfolding. Join us after the news.
KUER's volunteers give their time year-round to lend a helping hand. Our volunteers staff booths at special events, help with paperwork in our membership department, and assist the news and Radio West teams with behind-the-scenes details. Maybe you're a photographer or a graphic designer and you'd like to volunteer your skills. Or you have some spare time that you'd like to donate. We're always grateful for a little extra help from our friends. Find out more about volunteer opportunities at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Middle East experts are nervous about the news from Saudi Arabia, where leaders there have cut diplomatic ties with Iran in the wake of protests over the Saudi execution of an outspoken Shiite cleric. The experts are worried that tensions between Shiites and Sunnis could cause more instability in an already unstable region. The journalist Leslie Hazelton says there have been moments of peace and coexistence between those two factions over the centuries, but she says the split is always there, always ready to be used to explain or to justify conflict. But what exactly do we know about that rivalry? If you traced it back, how far would it go? Who were the players? And what was the reason for the schism in the first place? Well, Leslie Hazelton says, go back far enough and you'll find a story, a vivid and epic and dramatic story. And so today in the program, we've asked her to join us to take us through that story, the story of the Shia-Sunni split in Islam. We invite you to join us if you like. If you have any comments or questions, 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Leslie Hazelton is a journalist who reported from Jerusalem for 13 years. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, in Harper's, and other publications. Among her books is a biography of Muhammad called The First Muslim. She joined us a few years ago to talk about that. She also has a new book called Agnostic, due out later this year. We're talking about, though, another of her books. It's called After the Prophet. And Leslie Hazelton is joining us today from NPR member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. Leslie Hazelton, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
How much do you figure the Western world, and really, honestly, understands about this story of the split and this division in Islam?
Sorry, I think that laugh kind of says it.
Yeah.
As you said, it's a story usually told sort of, dismissively in a sentence, maybe two sentences, maybe even a very, very short paragraph. And what it comes down to is, it was a dispute over the succession to Muhammad. Like, that's all there is to it, right? Yeah. And in fact, when you go back to the earliest Islamic histories, which are just fulsome in their detail, and the main one is by a guy called Al-Tabari, written about 200 years later, which comes to 39 volumes in English translation. And it is just like being in the middle of this vast desert grapevine. So everybody is telling their memories and so on of what happened. 150 years before, because the split goes back basically to the moment of Muhammad's death.
Yeah.
Because the tragedy of it, the huge if only of it, and of course that if only is the essence of every tragedy, every tragic story. If only they hadn't, if only he had, and so on. If he had only had a son.
Yeah.
He was married for 24 years, monogamously, I might add, to his first wife, Khadija. He married 9 wives later, after her death. But that was a real love match. And with her, he had 4 daughters and 2 sons, but both of them died in infancy. Don't forget, this is 7th century Arabia, so sons inherited, not daughters. But the strange thing is that after her death, as I say, he married 9 more times. Sounds like a lot, but for that time, for a leader, it was kind of de rigueur. That's what leaders did. You made political alliances through marriage. He never had a child with any of the other wives. Never. So he died at age 63 of natural causes, which is kind of amazing, seeing, you know, considering how many times he'd been wounded in battle or there'd been assassination attempts against him. He died of what sounds very, very much like bacterial meningitis, which takes 10 days from onset to the final moment. So he knew he was dying. And also at that age, you know, especially at that time, that was a good old age, he can't have expected to live much longer. So the question is, why didn't he appoint a successor, someone to lead what he was leaving behind him, which was this newly united Arabia, all the tribes of Arabia united under the banner, as it were.
Isn't that the irony, too? Because at this moment, and we're going to really sort of back into the story as we go, because I want to have you work through it. But isn't that the interesting irony that when Muhammad dies, there is coexistence, there is peace, there's unity, And then this schism happens.
There's unity under what's known in the Middle East as a strong leader.
Yeah.
You know, you have to ask why he didn't appoint a successor. Of course, the Sunnis say he did, and the Shia say he did.
Yeah.
The Shia, by the way, it comes from Shi'at Ali, the followers of Ali. And Ali was Muhammad's nearest male relative. He was his first cousin and also his son-in-law. And also a kind of adopted son, basically, of he and Khadija. And the Shia are absolutely sure that Muhammad appointed Ali as his successor. And equally assured, the Sunnis are convinced that Abu Bakr, who was the father of Muhammad's youngest wife, Aisha, that he was the appointed one.
Nice.
And if you go through all the records, it seems to indicate here and it seems to indicate there, but at no point did Muhammad ever say, yes, this is the one I want to lead this newly united people of Islam after me. And there's probably very good reasons for that because, you know, I said it started on his deathbed. It was the tensions were there before, as they are around any great man, right?
Yeah.
The sort of tensions for, you know, people striving for his attention, people striving for the succession, sort of keeping it under, but sort of really kind of at loggerheads with each other. And he must have known that if he had definitively appointed a successor, then there would be a split right then and there. And what was particularly important to him was unity. This
yeah.
whole idea, one God, one people, one nation, right, under the banner of Islam. And the fear of everybody involved in this story, which goes multi-generational, it goes through 3 generations, from the moment of Muhammad's death till 50 years after, and ends in terrible tragedy. The fear always was of this thing called fitna in Arabic. And fitna means, literally it means kind of chaos and destruction, but it came to mean civil war.
Yeah. In a simple way, I suppose, although there's nothing simple about the story, it's this battle over who would lead Islam after Muhammad dies. But
Good.
You have boiled it down even further. You've said in some ways, and maybe this helps us understand something about the split today, the conflict today. You've said in some ways it was a battle between idealism and pragmatism, and in fact still is. Explain that, if you would.
Yes, idealism, pragmatism, purity, and compromise. You could say that Sunni history, and of course, you know, sort of, actually it's amazing how few Sunnis know the whole story of this, even though it's in the Sunni history books, they don't go into it in detail. The way the Sunnis tell history, it's the people of Islam are sacred, and the decision of the majority. Actually, the decision is by consensus. That is, there's a saying of Muhammad's, which may or may not be, you know, reliable, as most of these sayings, the hadith, you know, they're it's difficult to tell which ones are actual because they came into being centuries later. But the saying is that Muhammad said, my people, meaning my people of Islam, will never agree in error. And therefore, the assumption is that if you disagree, you must be, quote unquote, in error, and therefore not part of the people of Islam, which is the Sunni approach towards Shia. On the one hand, the Sunni approach was through an institute called the Shura, which still takes place throughout the Middle East, which is a gathering in which everybody tries to come to a consensus. Now, I live in Seattle, which is very much a consensus politics kind of town. I can tell you, consensuses are simply a matter of wearing down the opposition until finally they say, oh, God, all right, I give up, right? And that's how it was then, too. So it's a conflict between who actually was the immediate successor to Muhammad, who became the first caliph, which is from the Arabic Khalifa, meaning successor, as to who should have been the first caliph, who was for the Shia, Ali, because they were the Shi'at Ali, the followers of Ali, or Abu Bakr, and then after him, two others, until finally Ali became caliph. He was the fourth caliph, and he was assassinated after just 5 years. In fact, of the first four caliphs, and this is what's astonishing when you listen to the ISIS and the Taliban and the Al Qaeda ideologues and their longing to, you know, reestablish the caliphate and how great it was in during Muhammad's time and in the years right after Muhammad, and they call the first four caliphs the rightly guided ones. But you know, of these rightly guided ones, only one died a natural death, and that was of old age. The other three were all assassinated, two of them by other Muslims. This was not the golden age that the extremists seem to think it was.
There's a moment in the story, I think critical to understanding this split. And it's a massacre that played out more than 1,300 years ago in a place now known as Karbala. And explain, we're going to really work through the details of this moment. But just broadly first, explain how important this moment was, because in the book you call it really the foundation story for the split.
Oh, yeah. It's the passion story of Islam. And it's equivalent in power. In fact, it's greater in power than the passion story of the Christ. And it has to do with Ali was Muhammad's son-in-law, first cousin, and eventually became the fourth caliph, except the Shia, his followers, refused to recognize the former three caliphs. In fact, they refused to recognize the caliphate at all. They referred to him as the first imam, the first leader. Right? He was assassinated. A Sunni caliph took over. And a very, very wily, wonderful guy that no one in the West has heard of, called Muawiyah. Muawiyah is the image of the Byzantine. This is anachronistic because Byzantine was a little bit earlier, but he was the image of the Byzantine politician. He was very, very crafty in the exercise of power and was under no illusion that he represented any kind of spiritual authority. The first four caliphs were said to be both spiritual and political leaders. With Muawiyah, that came to an end. Muawiyah dies and appoints his son, his successor, right? Yeah. And his son is called Yazid. And Yazid is a swear word in Shia Islam. In fact, Sheikh al-Nimr, who was just beheaded in Saudi Arabia, used to call the Saudis Yazids, right? This is the images, the names, the events from what happened 1,400 years ago in Iraq are still alive and well and used all the time. They were used during the Islamic Revolution in Iran. They were used during the Iran-Iraq War. They were used in Iraq right now and that in Saudi Arabia by the Shia minority. And by the way, it should be noted that while the Shia are only 10% of the population of Saudi Arabia, which we know is adheres to an extremely conservative version of Islam. They live mainly in the east of the peninsula, where the oil is. And in fact, if you look throughout the Middle East, wherever the oil, there is the most oil under the ground, the Shia are the majority on top of the ground. And so what's been happening is that basically religion is being used, is being manipulated in order to protect oil, money, and power. That's an old story. Thus it ever was and ever will be, probably.
Yeah. Mm. Leslie Hazelton is with us. Her book that we're talking about is called After the Prophet, the epic story of the Shia-Sunni split in Islam. And we'll take a break and be back in a moment. We'll continue the story when we get back. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are trying to make sense of the sectarian rivalry in the Middle East. The latest version, of course, is playing out in Saudi Arabia, which has just cut diplomatic ties with Iran. And this is a centuries-long argument between Sunni and Shia. And if you're going to understand what's happening today, the violence and the wars, you have to understand this split. It's the story of Islam's first civil war, and the journalist Leslie Hazelton has studied the story. She's with us today to explain how personal rivalries and petty jealousies really brought about Islam's great schism. The book we're talking about that she wrote a few years ago is called After the Prophet, the epic story of the Shia-Sunni split in Islam. She's joining us from NPR member station KUOW in Seattle. Yeah, I wanted to ask you about, well, do we know why it is that Muhammad had so few children and no surviving sons? I mean, you mentioned in the book he wasn't sterile, he wasn't impotent. We're pretty sure of that. And we know his wives weren't barren. I mean, there's some belief that that there was a price to receiving revelation. That's why he didn't have sons, or that he was celibate in some way. Do we think we know what that was about?
I don't think we know. Official pious explanation is that, as you say, it was the price of revelation that he could have no more children. He did have four daughters. Mm-hmm. And it's through those four daughters that so many tens of thousands of people today can still claim to be descendants of Muhammad, because, of course, there's been 14 centuries. In the meantime, right. Lots and lots of children have been born. But it's very hard to know. Or was he celibate? There is no knowing. All we know is that he had four surviving daughters, no surviving sons, and that he had no children with any of the nine wives he married after the death of his beloved first wife, Khadija. Mm-hmm. And that except for the one who was the only one who was a virgin when he married her, the youngest one, Aisha, the others all already had children by other men. So we know that, they were fertile. Mm. So it's one of those mysteries. But So it really does come to this thing of, does it go by blood? Does the succession go by blood, or does it go by the acknowledgement of the community as a whole? And by the way, these arguments weren't so petty. By the time this was taking place, Islam was poised to become this major, major world power, the Muslim empire. When Ali, who was the fourth caliph and was Muhammad's cousin and son-in-law, was assassinated in Iraq, he was in Iraq for a good reason. There was a big garrison town there, and it was the center of this rapidly expanding Muslim empire, which was mainly, by the way, not at the point of the sword. It expanded economically. But the real tragedy came a generation later. They say this is a three-generational saga. So you have Muhammad, Ali, his son-in-law, and then Ali's son, Hussein. And Hussein, after his father was assassinated, retreated back to Mecca, to Medina, in fact. Meanwhile, Muawiyah, the fifth caliph, points his son Yazid, the sixth caliph. Yazid turns out to be authoritarian, is putting it mildly, institutes an incredibly repressive regime, especially in Iraq, where there's lots and lots of followers of Ali, of Shi'at Ali, Shia. And finally, what happens is that the Shia in Iraq call on Hussein back in Arabia to come save them, to come head them up, to come rise up against the oppressor, rise up against the tyrant Yazid. And there are the original histories have these impassioned calls for him to come, yeah. come save them, come lead them. Under his leadership, they will rise up. Under his leadership, justice will be attained. They will stop oppression. They will stop repression and so on. And it's incredibly impassioned. You can understand why it has such force today for Shia today. The repression of Shia and oppression of Shia in Bahrain, for instance, which is majority Shia but ruled by Sunnis, in the eastern part of Saudi Arabia, which, as we all know, is an appallingly repressive regime, yeah. to put it mildly. It is in Iraq. So these impassioned calls reverberate today, and they're echoed today, and so on, and used today. This principle of justice and so on is the idea of sacrificing oneself for justice comes from these early stories, because Hussein gets the call. Yeah. He sets out from Mecca to go 700, 800 miles to the middle of Iraq with 72 warriors and their wives and children, and his wives and children. And he knows that what's waiting for him there is Yazid's army of 4,000 men. I mean, this is clearly he knew what he was doing, in the same way you could say that Jesus knew what he was doing when he left Galilee and went to Jerusalem and caused that uproar in the temple and so on. There was only one possible outcome. Yeah. It was self-sacrifice. And the same can be said for Hussein in this case. And he, in fact, this is where he begins to achieve a kind of Christ-like stature for devout Shia.
I want to go through that part of the story, but let's back up just a bit, because we have to get to one of my favorite characters in the story, and that is Aisha. This is after she becomes Muhammad's favorite wife.
Well, that's what she claimed.
That's what she claimed. Okay.
And she lived longer than anybody else in this story. So yes. She had lots of time to claim.
Exactly. And I really like these stories of her, because you describe her when she was young as, you know, one of these spirited teenagers who's full of excitement and eager for adventure. In fact, you say she's kind of the antithesis of this usual image we have of Muslim women. She had a really sharp tongue and really spoke her mind. Tell us a little bit about Aisha.
Feisty.
Yeah.
Wonderfully feisty. Yes, she claimed to be, I mean, she always claimed that she was special. You know, she was the only wife that he took, you know, in later life, who was, well, you know, I call them the late life wives, the nine wives he married after Khadija. She was the only one who was a virgin when he married her. She was the youngest. She was his favorite. She was the only one who could make him laugh, which was quite an achievement, because he was known to very, very rarely even smile. She was constantly, she had a knack of making herself the center of attention. And there are wonderful stories, you know, connected with her. But perhaps the most striking one, and the one that is most challenges 21st century perceptions of women in Islam, is that 20 years after Muhammad's death, she led an army of 10,000 men into battle against Ali, who was then the caliph.
Yeah.
She led an army into battle against him. Her army lost, and she was wounded, probably more in her vanity than in her than in physically, though she did have an arrow in her shoulder. But I mean, just it was called the Battle of the Camel, after the camel on which she rode in a howdah. It was a red camel. And they say that, you know, by the end of the battle, the howdah was studded with arrows like a porcupine with quills. She led an army in the first civil battle between Muslims and Muslims against Muhammad's cousin and his son-in-law. Mm. his youngest wife, or his youngest widow by then. I mean, this is astonishing.
Yeah.
This is, and all through the story, women play major, major roles, but none quite as major and none quite as upfront and as sharp-tongued and sharp-actioned, as you say, as Aisha, an extraordinary figure.
There's a story that happens before all of that, before she leads these troops into battle. She's used to having her own way, and there's a particular expedition. This is before the prophet dies, of course, and she's left behind on this massive excursion, and she's rescued by a young Medinan warrior. But, uh-huh. but the optics of all of that don't look so good, because he finds her alone in the desert and rescues her and brings her back, and as you say in the book— tongues begin to wag. Rumors persist. Oh, yeah. It's believed that it's improper for this woman, the wife of the prophet, to have been with this warrior. This is what you write in the book. You say, incredible as it seemed, the future of the new faith seemed to hang on a teenage girl's reputation.
Yes.
So talk about this moment. She's in a bind, really.
Mm-hmm. If she had been unfaithful to Muhammad with this man, right, then that would, you know, destroy his credibility and so on. So he was in a terrible bind. She was in a bind because she swore that, quote unquote, you know, nothing had happened. And I'm absolutely sure that's true because, you know, she was quite savvy enough to know that you don't risk everything for a fling in the middle of the desert. You know, she was left behind by accident, by the way.
Right.
There's a whole story, you know, associated with that called the Affair of the Necklace. It was about a necklace. Long story. It's in the book in any case. But
it's a great story.
So you know, she gets rescued by you know, somebody comes along and finds her, brings her back, this warrior, good-looking, of course, unmarried, of course, and those tongues start to wag. And everybody delights in this because, as you can imagine, you know, when you're sharp-tongued and sharp-actioned, you don't make yourself too popular, certainly not among your rivals, who are the other eight wives of Muhammad in his late life. So everybody's sort of licking their lips at this, and the gossip goes round and round. And it ends up, quite fortunately for Aisha, and very unfortunately, I would say, for devout Muslim women afterwards, because what happened was that Muhammad had another revelation, one of the Quranic revelations, and the Quran, of course, is made up of these, you know, revelations, these divine revelations. As Aisha once sharply told him, you know, the revelation seemed to be very well timed.
Right.
This one was definitely very well timed. It declared that nothing had happened in the desert, that she was pure, that she was unsullied. And that henceforth, you know, anyone who made such accusations against her was engaged in a criminal act, because there had to be four witnesses to any such rape or adultery.
Yeah.
And of course, the result of that, in the hands of the Wahhabis, the Salafis, the extremist, you know, practices of Islam, has been that basically there's no such thing as rape, because you need four witnesses, which is absurd.
Mm.
You know, and therefore it's the woman who gets punished, because she's lying. She can't have been raped because there weren't four witnesses. I mean, it's just so. So this is an example of how something that actually happened and found expression in the Quran gets manipulated, gets turned around, gets totally distorted, in fact, to the point of obscenity by later clerics for their own purposes, for their own reasons.
So this particular moment when Muhammad is trying to figure out what to do about Aisha and this rumor that's going about,
uh-huh.
and, this is that first, as you say in the book, it's the first open expression of the crack in this newly formed bedrock.
Right.
Of Islam.
Because Ali.
You have Ali on one hand, who's Ali, who tells the prophet, just divorce her.
Right. Right. Which he may well have told him, but you know, word got out.
Yeah.
You know, and word did get out. It was a small community. They were living very close to each other. It was very hard to keep secrets. Word got out. And of course, when Aisha and her father, Abu Bakr, who remember becomes the first successor of the first caliph, when they hear it, well, obviously, I mean, Between them and Ali, there is never that. That's where the, in a sense, that's where the rift begins. You know, you can try and pinpoint beginnings so many ways, but it's a whole network, you know, of relationships and of antagonisms and of rivalries and of that led to it. And it's all very, very human. You know, when you come right down to it, these are people, and they're people behaving as people did, do, and always will do as human beings. They're not perfect.
Yeah.
And this is one of the fascinating things about the whole story.
You know, another thing I like about this story, and I'm sure it's a bit of a diversion maybe, but it's the interesting point that you make out, that you make in the book, about the idea of family, because the idea of family then was incredibly expansive, much broader than the kind of Western idea of family.
Oh yeah, we have such a boring idea of family, it's
right?
Totally linear, you know, sort of the family tree, and it sort of, you know, branches off at regular intervals and so on. And there, it's more like a sort of vast, sort of a vast, you know, vine in the jungle, sort of, you know, the tendrils come in and out and wind back on themselves and intertwine and so on, because not only could wealthy men have up to four wives, but women married several times too, where men could do it simultaneously, women did it serially. So, you know, the women could divorce, could simply ask for a divorce or declare a divorce and marry someone else and so on. If someone was died in battle, the wife would marry again. So as a result of this, you had this huge network of half-brothers, of half-sisters, of cousins and second cousins, third cousins, fourth cousins, fifth cousins and so on. And they intermarried. So very often, for instance, the first four caliphs, the first four successors to Muhammad, two were his fathers-in-law. I love that phrase, fathers-in-law. Right. Both of whom, by the way, were younger than he. And the next two were both his sons-in-law.
Yeah.
And the fifth one, Muawiyah, was his cousin-in-law, which makes Yazid, the great enemy of the Shia, his second cousin-in-law. I mean, it's just, this is how it goes. And as I say, this is why so many people today can claim to be descendants of Muhammad, even though he left no sons, no direct male heirs.
I want to have you do a few readings here, because I have to say, it's such a compelling story, the massacre at Karbala. This is where
it has to be a compelling story. You know, how else would it have retained its force over 14 centuries?
Well, exactly.
You know, it has to go deep.
Exactly. And this is, of course, as you mentioned, where Muhammad's grandson, Hussein, is killed. Now, explain why this is such an important moment. This is where the split really crystallizes in many ways.
It reverberated throughout the empire at the time, because the unthinkable had been done. This is the story of the massacre of Muhammad's family and of his grandson. And his grandson had, there were two of them. The first one was probably poisoned. But Hussein, I mean, they were the apples of Muhammad's eye. There were stories of him, getting down, sort of, you know, playing horsey with them, sort of, you know, they'd climb up on his back and he'd sort of crawl around and go around, clip clop, and so on. He just took a delight in them, which, you know, you see him happy. Which is very, very unusual. Everything he did was amazing, and it was impressive. But it's hard to say that this was a happy man, right? Mm-hmm. Except when he was with his grandsons. So Hussein, his grandson, travels to Iraq, called there by the followers of his father, the Shi'at Ali, the Shia, to come save them, to come lead the uprising against the tyrant Yazid. And obviously what happens is that they get, Yazid sends his forces to cut them off from reaching the garrison town where they could actually have some effect. And his forces cut them off between the Euphrates, between the river and the desert. In other words, they have no access to water.
Right. That's the critical point, at least in this particular point.
There are no wells there. Yeah. They're in the middle of barren desert, no access to water. And the idea is that they will just give in from sheer thirst and starvation, which does not happen, because they decide to fight and to die one by one, all 72 of the warriors.
Finishing,
of course, with Hussein.
Yeah. There's a really you call it in this reading. This is on page 186. I'd like you to read this part where this is the most one of the most iconic images. And this is Hussein's infant son. And it's just – it's kind of a terrible story, of course, in many ways. But I wanted you to read this, and I'll have you read another section when we go to a break a little bit later, which gives you a sense of, as you just said a moment ago, why this story endures because of the intense kind of drama. And the fact that we know in the West a couple of sentences of this story, when you hear the telling of like this particular horrible moment – it gives you a sense of why that sectarian rivalry is so
and these,
intense.
And these scenes, by the way, are also literally images. They are on posters that you can find all through the Shia world. In Iraq, in the marketplaces outside mosques, hanging in just about every home. In Iran, in Iraq, in Bahrain, in eastern Saudi Arabia, you will see these brightly colored posters showing scenes like this one. Okay, I'll read here.
Please.
Perhaps the most iconic image of all was that of Hussein's infant son. Just 3 months old, he was so weak from dehydration that he could no longer even cry. Hussein himself, despairing, came out in front of the tents and held the infant up in his arms for all the enemy to see. His voice cracked and parched with thirst. He begged the men to have mercy on these children, to allow water, at least for them. The only reply was an arrow, shot straight into the neck of the infant, even as he lay in Hussein's outstretched hands. They say that the infant's blood poured between Hussein's fingers onto the ground, and that as it did so he called on God for vengeance. But stories told again and again through the generations developed their own logic. In time it was said that Hussein beseeched God not for vengeance, but for mercy. "O God, be my witness and accept this sacrifice," he said, and the infant's blood flew upward from his hands in defiance of gravity and never returned to earth. And then came the eve of the final day. This was a siege, basically, that lasted 10 days, and the Arabic for 10 is Ashura, and it was the 10th day of the month of Muharram, and ever since has been commemorated as Ashura, this huge Shia commemoration where all these events are reenacted in passion plays. Then came the eve of the final day, Ashura, the 10th of Muharram, the setting for the Shia equivalent of the Last Supper. Hussein begged those of his men who still survived to leave him to his fate. "All of you," he said, and these quotes, by the way, are not from me, they're from the earliest Islamic historians. "All of you, I hereby absolve you from your oath of allegiance to me and place no obligation upon you. Go home now under cover of darkness. Use the night as a camel to ride away upon. These men of Yazids want only me. I beg you, leave for your homes and your families." They stayed. Their mouths parched, lips swollen, voices harsh and rasping with thirst, they swore never to leave him. "We will fight with you until you reach your destination," one of them proclaimed. And another, "By God, if I knew that I was to be burned alive and my ashes scattered and then revived to have it done to me again 1,000 times, I still would never leave you. How then could I leave you when what I now face is a matter of dying only once?" "Then call upon God and seek his forgiveness," said Hussein, "for our final day will come tomorrow." And then he used the Islamic phrase uttered in the face of death, "We belong to God, and to God we shall return."
This gives you a real sense, doesn't it, of why it is the Islamic revolution in Tehran in 1979 took hold of a story like this, the idea of occupation and the idea of independence. I mean, that really brings
rising
it to
up,
life.
Of rising up against tyranny, rising up against authoritarian government, rising up against injustice. Yes, this is a constant theme throughout this Shia passion story and a constant theme throughout Shia history. I mean, I should stress here that there have been times, long periods of time, when Shia and Sunni have coexisted quite peacefully. And Iraq, before the American invasion, in fact, Iraq was one of the places where that was most clear. Yeah. In fact, there was a lot of intermarriage, too, between Shia and Sunni. But the thing is that it's always there. These images are always there. This desire for justice, this idealism, this life as it should be or history as it should be rather than as it was or as it is always there. And it's always there to be called upon as Sheikh al-Nimr did before he was beheaded in Saudi Arabia. Always there to be, to move people, to move them to action. To uprising, to perhaps revolution.
Yeah. Leslie Hazelton is with us, the author of the book, After the Prophet, the epic story of the Shia-Sunni split. We'll take another break and continue the story in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with journalist Leslie Hazelton. We're talking about her book, After the Prophet, the epic story of the Shia-Sunni split. She's joining us from NPR member station KUOW in Seattle, Washington. I want to ask you about Hussein's death. And I don't want to oversimplify this, but it, I guess it can be said that Hussein's death is in some ways an act of martyrdom. What do you see that idea of martyrdom as influencing the way Muslims see martyrdom today? Is there a connection there?
Yes, I would say so. Yeah. Yes, it was an act of martyrdom. He's celebrated as a martyr. He's revered as a martyr. Again, it depends on what you mean by martyrdom. Today, you know, Sunni, and by the way, most of the suicide bombers are Sunni, nearly all of them.
Yeah.
It's a different concept of martyrdom, right? But the Shia concept of martyrdom is basically emulation, is sacrificing oneself for the sake of justice and so on. It's easy to generalize and so on. And also, you know, when we say that, you know, Shia and Sunni, the differences are not that large. They have to do with symbolism, with iconography, with, obviously the Sunni, especially the more conservative branches of Sunni, like the Saudi one, any kind of iconography is forbidden, right? Haram. Yeah. But the Shia tradition is very, very strong in iconography, on posters, on reenactments, on people dressing up as the main actors in this incredibly impassioned drama. In fact, every year in Muharram, it's reenacted in passion plays, and these are passion plays that make the old Catholic Oberammergau passion plays seem very, very mild by comparison. Major mourning for the death and the self-sacrifice of heroes and saints.
I want to have you read this section when Hussein is killed. And we should explain who Shimmer is. He's a pretty ruthless general of Yazid.
Yeah, Shimmer was the commander of Yazid, the Caliph Yazid, the sixth Caliph, the Caliph Yazid's forces in Iraq. And he was, ruthless is a very good word for him. Okay, so the sun rose inexorably on the morning of the 10th of Muharram, October 10th in the year 680. As it gained height, the last of the 72 warriors in Hussein's encampment went out one by one to meet their deaths. By the time the sun was high in the sky, only Hussein himself remained. He said farewell to the women of his family, mounted his white horse, Laik, the pursuer, he was called, and rode out from the tents to confront his destiny. As he charged into the enemy lines, the archers fired volley after volley. Arrows studded the horse's flanks, yet still he kept charging. Astride him, Hussein struck out left and right with his sword, and for a few moments it hardly seemed to matter that he was only one man against 4,000. "By God, I've never seen his like before or since," one of the archers would remember. The foot soldiers retreated from him as goats retreat from an advancing wolf. But it couldn't last. "Why are you waiting?" Shimmer yelled at his troops. You sons of men who urinate at both ends. Arabic is very good for swearing. Kill him, or may your mothers be bereaved of you. Which is a classic oath. May your mothers be bereaved of you. It's just kind of chilling. An arrow struck home in Hussein's shoulder, and the force of it threw him to the ground. And finally, they crowded in on him. By the time they were done, there were 33 knife and sword wounds on his body. It was as though trying to hide the evidence. They spurred their horses over his corpse again and again, trampling the grandson of the Prophet into the dust of what would be known as Karbala. At that moment, what the Sunnis consider history became sacred history for the Shia, and the aura of sacredness would permeate the memories of what happened next. There's no mention in the earliest accounts of Hussein's three-year-old daughter, Sukaina, roaming the battlefield. No mention either of tears streaming from the eyes of his white horse or of the sudden appearance of two white doves. But who can hold that against the millions of Shia for whom Ashura is what defines them? Details accrue around a story of such depth and magnitude in the Passion of Hussein as in the Passion of Christ.
You know, you write about, just later in that section, you write, with time it would make no difference.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
And you say, you know, whether, in fact, there was one particular story, one story of a man who fought with one arm right. And then had the other arm severed. Uh-huh. And you say it doesn't really matter if these were actual real facts or if the doves really did fly down, as you just read.
Yeah.
Faith and need said they did. Explain about that, because this is the thing that I thought was so compelling about this moment. You say these stories have become, here's how you put it, as true as the most incontrovertible fact.
Uh-huh. If not more so,
yeah.
Because they have such depth of meaning. It's, history kind of soars into meta-history. It kind of enters the realm of faith and inspiration and of passion, by which I mean both emotional and religious passion. It's, history is what we believe happened, right? It's the record of what somebody believed happened, and it gets embroidered over time. We came to think there is, in a sense, no science of history. History is an art. It's a creative process, right? Mm-hmm. It's an act of the imagination, which is not to say that it's not based on fact, but it's what the fact means to someone. It's the way it's told. And the way I've told it in this book is trying to bring across the way it's told in Shia Islam, to bring across the force of it. And it's one thing that struck me in the reception of this book is how many comments and how much I heard from Sunni Muslims saying, oh my God, I never realized. I didn't realize the force of it. I didn't realize how deep this went. Nobody ever told us.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things you've talked about, understanding the story, to me, it seems like you have to understand how the story is about Shiite, as we said before, kind of Shiite liberation, which is relevant if you are going into a country and you're seen as occupiers. Yeah. And if you think about Ali, who is assassinated near Najaf, and the city basically rises around his shrine, and it's in Najaf where American troops were. I mean, it just seemed like not knowing, not understanding the importance of those sites, of those moments of this story had a profound effect on it. Yeah.
Everything in the Middle East, the whole story of American involvement in the Middle East and of British and French involvement in the Middle East before them is one of simply just not getting it, of imagining that somehow you can use this one way or another to your advantage, right? We can support Saudi Arabia no matter what they've done because we need the oil and because originally, you know, Saudi Arabia was under American influence, stood against Nasser's Egypt under Russian influence. It was part of that whole Cold War thing. But ever since then, basically, it's oil. And it's all about oil, the whole story. And, of course, what's happening now is a deliberate provocation absolutely deliberate provocation on the part of Saudi Arabia, because now it looks as though, you know, with the pact signed and the nuclear pact signed in 2015, as though Iran is becoming acceptable again in the West, more so, in fact, in Europe than here in the United States. And it's that was a deliberate provocation. There was no doubt about what was going to happen. So there's a power struggle going on. Mm-hmm. For who represents, who leads the Muslim world, as though there were such a thing as a monolith called the Muslim world. Yeah. There isn't. There are, in fact, as many Islams as there are Muslims. The same can be said for Jews and for Christians, by the way. There is no one defining monolith there, even though, you know, we seem to imagine that there is. So it's a power struggle, and it's a power struggle which uses religion. And it uses religion not so much even for the content of the religion, but as a matter of identity. When nation states are so frail and so vulnerable, so friable, and can be broken up so easily, especially in a region like the Middle East where there are so many ethnicities, from clan to tribal to, you know, much greater, religion becomes religious identity. It becomes merged with personal identity, right? In the same way that, for instance, now many American Muslims, you know, who never go anywhere near a mosque, are suddenly finding that Muslim has become a much more important part of their identity because they're perceived that way, right? Even though they may not be at all religious, may in fact be quite atheist. In that same way, Shia and Sunni have become very, very important once again in the Middle East. Where it will lead? I don't know. You know, we always hear about the times that it erupts. You know, it's like television news, flames lead. So we hear about the times when it erupts in civil war and warfare and so on. And we forget the times when sanity rules and people actually live together, coexist in peace.
Leslie Hazelton. We were talking about her book, After the Prophet, the epic story of the Shia-Sunni split in Islam. She has a new book coming out that we're all looking forward to called Agnostic, due out later this year. I want to ask you about it because we don't have the time, but I can't wait to talk to you about it when it comes out.
Well, emphasize the subtitle, A Spirited Manifesto.
Oh, good. Okay, great.
Yes.
Leslie Hazelton joined us from NPR member station KUOW in Seattle. Thank you very much for being back with us.
Thanks so much, Doug.
Radio West, production of KUER News. Technical direction today from Michael Havey. Video West, produced by Josh Weathers. Radio West is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. And I'm Doug Fabrizio.